All right, listeners, this is the Grey Goose, and you're listening to 91.5 WGLZ. We have our very special guest with us here on the line today. He is a legend of automobile racing. He has 109 career wins on the major circuit, and he is the only man ever to win the Indy 500, Daytona 500, and the Formula One World Championship. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Mr. Mario Andretti with us here on the line today. Mario, how are you today?
Wonderful, Walker. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am doing great. So we're just going to get right into it. I'd like to discuss a little bit about your background. Where are you originally from?
Well, I was born and raised in Italy. And born just about the time the World War II started, 1940. You know, war started just a little after that. And I lived there the first 15 years of my life before we came to America.
Now, did you start racing when you were in Italy, or did it not occur till you moved to America?
Well, I would have loved to have started there, but of course I was still too young. But the other part was that, as you can imagine, the war lasted until 1946, and we actually were displaced because the region where I was born became Yugoslavia and was ceded to Yugoslavia because Italy obviously lost the war, and so that part succumbed to communist rule, hardline communism under Marshal Tito, and we had a choice to remain there and succumb to communism or leave. And so my parents obviously made a choice to leave. And so we were in a refugee camp there in our own country in Italy for 7.5 years in Lucca in Tuscany. And of course, things after the war were so upside down throughout Europe, as you can imagine. Unemployment and all that was rampant, and not much going on as far as looking at the future, you know, for my parents. So we kept in touch with an uncle on my mother's side who had been in America for many, many years, and he suggested to my dad, he said, why don't you come to the U.S. And then I said, I will sponsor you and guarantee, do all the guarantees necessary to obtain visa. So anyway, my dad applied for visa in 1952. And 3 years later, visas came through and decision time. And dad says, well, we're going to America. And of course, going back to my love for the sport, it did start in Italy, for sure. Obviously, Italy being so prominent in motor racing from the very beginning of Formula One. You know, Formula One officially started in 1951. The first world champion was Nino Farina, Italian, in Alfa Romeo. And, of course, you had the birth of Ferrari, Maserati, all very much involved and protagonists in Formula One throughout the world. And so as a young lad, my twin brother Aldo and I just became enamored with the sport just through the media, really. When coming to America, we just wanted to pursue that. We were lucky to see two of the major events held in Italy, one in 1954 at age 14, the Italian Grand Prix and in Monza, and right after that we saw the in 1955, just before we came over, we saw the Mille Miglia, which was a very famous road race around Italy, 1,000 miles, and with a Mercedes, Ferrari, Maserati, all big participants, and of course Fangio, and you had Moss and Ascari, all the icons of the era were there. And so you could see, you know, as kids we were so impressed, and just even especially watching Monza, it was just that's where I think the mold was cast for me and my brother. You know, we figure we will pursue this no matter what, and we did without a plan B. And so we came to the States. That's all we had in mind after school, just start building something.
When you came to America in 1955, what was the atmosphere like?
Well, the atmosphere, everything was very positive. When we sailed under the Statue of Liberty on June 16th, 1955, was my sister Anna Maria's 21st birthday. It was just a beautiful, beautiful day, 5 in the morning, with the ship was Conte Biancamano. And it was a very serene situation. We arrived, one of our cousins picked us up and then brought us to Nazareth, you know, about 80 miles away from New York. And that's where life began. But everything at the time was new new culture, new language, new a lot of things. But it was, everything was friendly, felt very welcome. Even us kids going to school, you know, obviously we were the foreigners in this small community, but there was a lot of curiosity, but we felt welcome. And luckily, Aldo and I had 3 years of English in Italy while schooling there, and so that helped us learning the process. And when we arrived here, we didn't have any practical knowledge of the language, but we know the grammar and so forth. It makes it a lot easier, so we mastered it pretty quickly. My goal was when we started school in September, I said by Christmas I want to have pretty good command of the language, and I think we accomplished that, because that year we got a A in English by Miss Paul, our wonderful English teacher. So that was kind of cute.
Very nice. How old were you when you entered your first race?
19. Actually, 2 years after we arrived here, Aldo and I and four other buddies, we started on this project. We started building a car, which eventually was designed for us to race by the time we were 21, because that was the legal age to race professionally. And but we finished the car 2 years later in 19, so we figured, well, you know what, we're not going to wait. So we had a local editor of the local newspaper here in Nazareth, a gentleman by the name of Les Young, which accommodated us, and he sort of fudged the birth dates on our license, on our driver's license. You know, so as you can see, Walker, with no computer in those days, so you could get away with these things. And so all of a sudden, we were both 21. And there was a local racetrack here. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you how we... why we all of a sudden felt very optimistic, because when we arrived here, I think it was on a Thursday, by Sunday, and which was in full-fledged, the season was underway, racing season, because, of course, June. And Sunday night, we were at my uncle's house, of course, and we see lights in the background, and bright lights, and all of a sudden we hear a big roar of engines. So Aldo and I looked at each other. We just booked, you know, we just followed the noise. And we discovered there was this half a mile dirt track at the fairgrounds. And they were driving these brutish looking modified cars, which obviously didn't look like Formula One, but still racing. And so Aldo and I looked at each other, and we felt, you know what? We both thought the same thing. You know, I think we could do this. I think it would be a lot easier to build something like this than the Formula One car. So it could be one way to get started. So 2 years later, as I said, we just started building this car and finished 2 years. So at age 19, that's when we started. One car, two drivers. Aldo and I had to, we were alternating. He would drive one weekend, I would drive the next. And the best part about it is that I think we did a pretty good job. Not just us, I give credit to, you know, to our friends, one in particular who was very knowledgeable about motor racing in America, who is the one that made all the suggestions to what type of car and what to do and how to get information. And so we did a better job than I thought, because Aldo was the won the toss, and he drove the first race, and he won. He won the very first race locally, and I did the following week the same. And we did all the crashing and all the other things, you know, along the way, but we had a very good first season.
Very nice.
So we had a very auspicious start.
Wonderful. Now, you had started off racing modifieds. What's the difference between a modified and a traditional car?
Well, the modified, just the word itself. Actually, ours was called Sportsman, which is one category below the modifieds, and they had two classes. Modified was the top class, and ours was Sportsman. Sportsman was obviously not as expensive and with less powerful engines, but it was still a very it was a category that would be pretty much, you know, move you on to the next level. At the same time, we actually our Sportsman was almost as quick as all the modifieds, because the very last race of the season, which was a you had to be you had to have be top three within in any track within 150 mile races, so you had to be invited. So we both got invited to the last race of the season in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, and we were racing our car against the modifieds and being competitive. So and that's it. I mean, it was just a car that was purpose built. But the basic car was like a 48 Hudson, to answer your question. But everything had to be pretty much modified: suspension, engine, and some of the body's works and so forth.
Okay, very nice. I always wondered what the difference was. That really helped give me a better idea of what the differences are.
Yeah, as I said, it's you take a basic existing car that obviously was a production car, but in those days, like a NASCAR, for instance, then they modify the existing production cars, you know, to make it more suitable for the rigors of racing and so forth, and that's what we did.
Wonderful. So after that stellar first season, where did you go from there?
Well, from there, I just I raced two seasons with our cars, and then my objective was to go to open wheel single seaters, and then went to midgets, and then sprint cars, and which was pretty much the ladder system to the top level of Indy cars, which was the ambitious goal that we had, and. It was an unfortunate situation for my brother Aldo, who had an accident while qualifying for that last race in Hatfield, and that actually ultimately even determined his career, you know, which only lasted 10 years, because he had another one after that. And he had a sabbatical even after that, but. I was lucky enough to continue and got into the midgets and on from there. You know, just I had a pretty natural progression, you know, through, in 62, 63, 64. by 1964, I earned a ride, a test drive for one of the top teams in IndyCar racing, and after the test drive, they gave me, that's it, they signed me up, and so I drove just part of the season in 64, but 65, my very full season, I was Rookie of the Year, Indianapolis, finished third. I won the national championship, was the youngest driver to do so at that point, and that was my very first year in IndyCars in 1965.
Awesome. What track were you racing on when you got your first win?
Oh, my first win was in Indianapolis, but not Indianapolis. It was a road course.
Hmm.
1965, I won the championship, but only won one race. I had a lot of second place finishes, and so with the point system, I still won the championship. But my very first race was actually a road race in IndyCars at a track called Indianapolis Raceway Park. And in fact, in subsequent years, the next 2 years, I won in 66, 67. Again, I won 3 years in a row there. I love road racing. That was my primary love. But at that time, on that season, there was only one road race counting for the championship. And then in subsequent years, we got more and more road races, which were also part of... So we had oval races and road races part of the championship season.
What's the mindset like from when you're racing on a road course compared to when you're on an oval track?
Well, the mindset is the same, obviously. I mean, you go there and you want to get the job done. You know, you just stay positive, and that's the only way, I think, to approach it. But it's a different technique that obviously has to be applied. So you got to just get in yourself in that zone. And that's, I think, the challenge. To try to be versatile enough so you're just as effective on an oval as you are on a road course, which are two different animals. That's why I love the IndyCar racing in particular, because of that.
Absolutely. What year did you win your first Indy 500?
Well, I was in 1969. 4 years later. 69 was, that's when I won Indy 500, yeah.
How many times did you win that race?
Indy, I won it twice. So actually, I won it once officially, twice. I won it because Bobby Unser, who was given the race back, actually had an infraction in the race, and they appealed the penalty, and somehow he was given the race back. And so, but that was in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the third all-time lap leader in Indianapolis, but I've had a tough time just getting to the end there. You know, a lot of unreliable engines and one thing or another, but I think on pole 3 or 4 times. Always, you know, started close to the front. I was always competitive there, but I didn't have much luck, you know, to finish in that race.
Was Indianapolis your favorite track to race on?
Absolutely not. There were many others. No, that was, it's one that I enjoy racing there for sure, but it was certainly not my favorite. But I try not to, you know, even quantify that, you know, in my own mindset, favorite, not favorite. They were all, I approached them all with a positive attitude. Because if you just start, you know, say, okay, this is my favorite, this is not my favorite, and so forth. I think if you go there with the mindset that, oh, I really don't like this place, I don't think you have much of a chance of bringing home any kind of being successful there, in other words. So Indy was, you know, one of the tracks, but I many others were our favorite. Let's put it this way. I'm getting tongue-tied on this one because I can say they were all my favorites. Let's put it that way.
There you go. That's the perfect answer. You had the opportunity to race in the Daytona 500. How did that opportunity come about?
Well, the opportunities came about from other teams and factories knowing that I had the desire to cross over to other disciplines, and I had a great relationship with Ford at the time, and racing for them with their engines and racing sports cars, and I expressed the desire to do some stock car races, and the biggest one was still is, I think, in NASCAR is Daytona, and they put me with one of their the factory team, which was Holman and Moody, and I just things worked out for me. I just had a very good competitive car, and I was able to make the most of it. But honestly, I led 118 of 200 laps, so I led more than half the race with a very strong competition there, and against some of the real icons of the sport of stock car racing at the time. And it was an incredibly satisfying win for me, of course, because that was not my specialty, if you will. My specialty has always been open wheel single seaters.
Mm-hmm. Now this year you were able to go back to Daytona. You were an honorary race official.
Yes, that was very nice. Of course, always maintain a great relationship, and we do with all of the disciplines of our sport. And that was a nice thing that they did for me, celebrating the 50th anniversary of my win. Yeah.
Now you also had the opportunity to race Formula One, and you won a championship at that level.
Yes, Formula One was always in the back of my mind as one of my definite goals in my career, and I worked myself toward that end throughout my career, and when I felt that it was time to go, I was always offered a top opportunity, a top ride with a top team. I've raced for Ferrari, I've raced for Lotus and so forth, and I was able to win with both. But the World Championship I won with Lotus. That was really my ultimate goal, quite honestly, mainly because I fell in love with Formula One when I first fell in love with the sport of motor racing. So that was still is, my favorite period in my career.
Now, since you raced in Formula One, you had the opportunity to race in a number of different countries. Do you know how many countries you've raced in?
I don't know many countries, but I raced in six continents throughout my career with both Formula One and also IndyCars when we raced internationally with IndyCars. So, and I won in five of the continents, different races. Yeah, I'm very proud of that part. We circle the world pretty much, wherever motor racing goes in those disciplines. And it was something very special about that because you feel that in a very international scene, you're representing your country. It's almost like every race is like you're competing in the Olympics. There's a lot of pride going there, and there's nothing better than when you win, you're on the podium, on the highest step of the podium, and they play your national anthem, whether you're in Japan, Argentina, Germany, France, wherever, Italy, and they play your national anthem first. I had a particular pride in winning also. As I said, Formula One is so international that it's a big feather in any driver's cap to win in their own country if you're German, of course, Germany and so forth. And in 1977, I won the U.S. Grand Prix in Long Beach. It's the country, in obviously, where my domicile is. And also won the Italian Grand Prix, the country where I was born. So I had a double, special victory there, which is something I'm very proud of.
Absolutely. Now, you're the only American to actually win a Formula One championship. Do you ever see more Americans racing in that series?
Actually, I'm the second American to win a Formula One championship. Phil Hill was the first one in 1961.
Oh.
So I'm the second one. Again, as an American driver, I've had really great success representing this country. Because I won more races than all the American drivers that ever raced in Formula One combined. So something I'm very proud of.
Absolutely. Now, this year they had the crossover with one of the Formula One drivers racing in the Indy 500. Do you ever see that kind of being replicated in somebody that would race in IndyCar going over to race in Formula One?
Well, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see crossovers. I think that's very healthy for the sport. And whenever you have someone set the example, sometimes it would probably maybe instigate some curiosity from somebody, and I'd like to see that happen more. It would be probably easier for an IndyCar driver to go do some Formula One races than... it was a very special situation with Fernando Alonso to come to a race at Indy rather than Monte Carlo, and only because this Formula One situation was not very competitive. So McLaren encouraged him to do that. But because there is a conflict with Monte Carlo and Indianapolis every year, you're very unlikely going to see that happen again, to have a top Formula One driver come into Indy anytime soon.
And that's a real shame, because when you have crossover events like that, it really helps both sports that are involved in the event.
I agree that very much. Indeed, I think it was a very popular move that Fernando made, which, again, was very popular here, of course, in the U.S. He was... received with open arms, and he felt that warm welcome, but also was very popular in Europe because they were curious to see how one of their drivers would do here, how competitive he would be, and he certainly did not disappoint, because he made his mark quite nicely and with a lot of pride. And so I agree with you. I think both disciplines, Formula One and IndyCar and motorsports in general, gained by seeing that move.
No, absolutely. Now, you raced up until the 1990s in the IndyCar series, and you won in four different decades. So you also competed during that time stretch in the 24 Hours of Le Mans. So what was that like, being in that sort of race?
Well, the 24 Hours of Le Mans is an event that always interested me. Very challenging in every way, very particular in its nature. I first raced at Le Mans in 1966, and my last race was in 2000. So that's quite a span. I had a great time. The time we had some good results there. In the past, that we had a class win in 1995. I love doing that. And one year in 88, there were three Andretti's teaming up with one of the Porsche factory cars, Le Mans, and I think we had a mechanical which kept us down to fifth place finish. But other than that, we were very, very competitive, and it was very satisfying. My son Michael and my nephew John were my teammates, so I have some very fond memories of races there. Michael and I, teammates back in '83, we finished third. Um, so I've some good memories of that, and I enjoy it. I love driving Le Mans very, very fast and incredibly challenging.
Absolutely. Now, one of the most beautiful things about you and your racing story is the fact that a lot of your family members are also racers.
Well, indeed. When I look back with my brother Aldo and I, there are four drivers on each side. I mean, Aldo is a race driver, and he has his son John, who raced both IndyCars and NASCAR. John has son Jared that races sprint cars, and then also my brother's youngest son Adam is racing in a Trans Am series. You know, so we got four race drivers, and on my side I have two sons, Michael and Jeff. Michael and both they raced Indy cars and sports cars and others, and of course my grandson Marco is a current IndyCar driver for my son Michael. So as you can see, as a family, we have a lot of skin in the game, and we've had it for a long time. But the other part about it is that I've had the opportunity to race with my son, as you say, and my nephew, you know, and his partner, the same team, but also we raced against each other. And then I had my son when I was racing for Newman Haas in IndyCars. I think it was about 3 years. We were teammates with the same team, and we finished on a podium, you know, something like 12, 14 times. We had really fantastic times together, and a lot of pride with the family. In 1991 and 92 in Indianapolis, there were four members of the same family, which was myself, it was Michael and Jeff, and my nephew John. And it's the first time ever that any family had four members racing at Indy, and never since. You know, so we're the only ones, the only family ever to have four members in that race. And so when we look back again, we have a lot to be proud for.
Absolutely. Now, you're kind of at the end of the era where a lot of races were family-oriented events, because, I mean, you had the Petties and the Earnhardts and the Allisons and NASCAR. You have yourself and your family in IndyCar. And it just seems like in more recent years, racing's kind of moved away from that family-oriented atmosphere.
I don't think racing moved away from it. It's just a cycle. It's a cycle of life, you know, where, you know, we paved the way, and then somehow, you know, there was, of course, Richard Petty, and then there was his son Kyle, and so forth. And there were other, based off the answers, you know, there were the older ones, and Junior, Andretti is the same. It was just a cycle of life. I think you might see that again, you know, with the new crop of drivers when, you know, they will have their offspring. You never know, you know, whether the there'll be some following, but it's nothing that's designed. It just either happens or it doesn't, only because it's just a natural evolution there, you know, with families.
Absolutely. Now, are you retired from full-time racing?
Well, I'm retired, yeah, from competition, but I still drive a two-seater car, which I give rides. I mean, it's like a 80-90% of the what the actual speeds are, but and I've done some high speed testing from my son Michael's team, and I still have my hand in it in some ways, but I'm not racing competitively anymore. I mean, I've done mine. At age 78, I don't see that's going to happen.
Now, what kind of advice?
77, by the way. I'm not going to be 78 until next February.
Well, we won't tell anyone. We'll just keep saying you're 77.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of advice do you have for younger people who are looking to go into racing?
Well, right now the system is pretty well. It's it's sort of a, it can accommodate, you know, just anyone that has some goals to pursue this, because you can be, you can enter one of the driving schools, competitive driving schools that are available, and be evaluated. And usually the instructors are pretty sharp. They can see whether there's some unusual talent that should be cultivated, and you'll get the right encouragement if you demonstrate something very special. And a lot of it stems from passion or desire, to pursue something like this. The ladder system is very healthy in our sport, to be able to just begin properly and then and follow through and get to the top levels. But it all starts with the desire, to pursue something like this. And then things will happen.
Absolutely. What kind of things do you like to do in your spare time to keep yourself busy?
Oh, I don't have a lot of spare time, but I just love the outdoors. I have, I have all sorts of so-called toys. I have ATVs. I have, boats. I have snowmobiles. I even do some sport flying. I fly in ultralights and my ultralight, of course, and I love the outdoors, play tennis, water ski, all those things.
Absolutely. So where do you see yourself? What does your future hold for you?
Well, I'll just keep doing all the things that I love to do, pursue my business interests and maintain relationships that standing relationship that I've had with different companies, especially with Firestone, Magnaflow, and I have a relationship with Honda, that keeps me in that two-seater program, and that's it, and just continue to be, to be close with the family and follow my son's, he's very ambitious with his teams in different categories of the sport, and of course cheer on my my nephews and my grandson.
Wonderful. As we get ready to wrap up this interview, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to hear today?
I think we covered it.
All right. Mario, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome, Walker. All the very best to you.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was legendary race car driver Mario Andretti. We are now going to get back to the music. Here is Life in the Fast Lane on 91.5 WGLZ.